much remains to be found out about the lifestyle of our forebears.
A construction crew discovers very old human remains near McGrath. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, November 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, residents of St. Lawrence Island react to reports of oiled animals.
We eat these things, and it's really important that we find out where this contamination is coming from.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by Older Persons Action Group, promoting well-being for Alaska seniors and their families, including publication of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper. Membership information at 1-800-478-1059.
A draft study shows design and construction flaws with the Port of Anchorage project. Officials with the firm CH2M Hill presented the study's findings to the Anchorage Assembly and Mayor today at City Hall. Engineers paid to review the port debacle say the main concern is that the work already done on the port would not hold up in a big earthquake, and that at the end of 50 years, it would be overstressed and not meet safety standards. The clay soil in Cook Inlet, they say, presented a serious challenge to construction. Mayor Dan Sullivan acknowledged that it appears some of the work already done likely cannot be repaired.
I'm not an engineer nor a construction expert to know whether or not some of that can be mitigated with construction techniques or not, but that's why I think we just need to be patient until February when we get the recommendation on how to proceed forward. But again, as was asked before, clearly there was an indication that some of this work is irreparable.
The Port of Anchorage expansion project has been in the works for more than a decade. The municipality of Anchorage partnered with the U.S. Department of Transportation Maritime Administration on the project. In 2003, construction got underway, then stalled around 2009 after serious construction problems came to light. Cost estimates skyrocketed. Upwards of $300 million public dollars have been spent on the project so far. Dr. Larry McAllister is with the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. He says his offices will be coming up with several design concepts, which they will be presenting this spring.
You know, an engineer, given enough time and money, we can repair and fix anything. The issue becomes how much time, how much money is available. Do we want to move forward with a completely different concept, the combination of the two? That's the sort of thing that we're going to be doing in the next several months.
The Corps of Engineers concepts for how to move forward will be a part of a second study that will identify the most promising alternative design and should be available by March. Sullivan says that's when his office will be able to put a price tag on the project. The only estimate he can give now is that it will cost hundreds of millions of dollars. The municipality has about $80 million on hand for the project and is set to receive another $50 million from a bond that was approved by voters on November 6th. Construction workers uncovered human remains near McGrath last month during work on an erosion control project along the Kuskokwim River. An investigation revealed their Athabascan origins. Results from scientific analysis was still very preliminary, but as KUAC's Emily Schwing reports, the findings could shed new light on the origins and history of interior Alaska Native people.
The discovery is known as Tawchuk McGrath Discovery. The name refers to the confluence of the Takotna and Kuskokwim Rivers at the village of McGrath. In early October, a construction worker out for a walk uncovered a skull exposed by earth-moving equipment.
You know, we thought, it's got to be this elder who disappeared about 30 years ago in McGrath.
That's Vicki Oddie. She's the CEO of MTNT, the local village corporation.
And the skull had absolutely perfect lower teeth. It's amazing. There were no cavities or anything. I mean, they were just in perfect shape. And I remember this missing elder from 30 years ago. She was in her 70s. Was always bragging about what good teeth she had, and so I knew it was her.
But the skull turns out to be from an Athabascan man, and he's much older than anyone expected. A radiocarbon dating method puts charcoal from a nearby fire pit at between 360 and 540 years old. but the remains were buried below the pit, so they're likely to be even older. The bones were found huddled together with two other skeletons, a young adult male and a male child between 2 and 5 years old. Tanana Chiefs Conference archaeologist Bob Sattler says prehistoric discoveries in interior Alaska are extremely rare because Athabascans traditionally cremated their dead. But there are other reasons bones of this age rarely survive.
Acidic soils in the boreal forest typically will dissolve bone. Nearly within a century.
The Tawchuk-McGrath discovery was found in what Sattler thinks is either an ancient sand dune or an abandoned sandbar, which could have aided in preservation. A team of archaeologists also found 3 fire pits nearby that contain fish and mammal bones. Sattler thinks these Alaska natives lived a fully subsistence lifestyle long before Russian fur traders migrated to the region.
The key factor when the excavation took place was that there were no metal or any trade goods.
But the team also found 2 shards of obsidian nearby one of the skeletons. It's a kind of volcanic glass many prehistoric Alaskans used for tools. This particular obsidian is from an ancient volcano near the village of Hughes, nearly 200 miles north of McGrath. Sattler says that could mean the prehistoric peoples of Alaska may have had their own ways of sharing goods.
And this presence of this exotic volcanic glass demonstrates that there was quite a network of trade at this time.
Because the bones are so well preserved, Sattler and his colleagues think they'll be able to analyze the DNA inside. The bones have been transferred to the Tanana Chiefs Conference temporarily. President Jerry Isaac says he's excited to help uncover their secrets.
Much remains to be found out about the lifestyle of our forebears. We're told that we're nomadic. We're the hunter-gatherer type of people. So, well, I'd like to know such things today as why the interior native people are susceptible to certain illnesses.
DNA studies might also tell scientists more about family lineages, human migration between Asia and North America, and even offer information about how Athabascans adapted to their subarctic surroundings. MTNT, the McGrath Village Council, and TCC plan to continue work with federal and state scientists to study and preserve the remains. The groups are working on plans for a full archaeological exploration next summer. The remains will be reburied after a complete scientific analysis. I'm Emily Schwing in Fairbanks.
Hunters on St. Lawrence Island have reported oiled wildlife, the most recent report this Monday. Responders from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation and the U.S. Coast Guard planned on arriving at the island to the communities of Gamble and Savoonga this evening. KNOM's Lorelei Kanin has the story.
Coast Guard spokesperson David Mosley says the first report was made October 25th about a seal that looked like it had some oil on it. Then a hunter on Monday came across birds that had oil on them. The Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation also received reports of oil-soaked debris that washed ashore on the island. Mosley says the culmination of reports raised red flags, prompting a closer look. The DEC says in a situation report that the product found on these animals and debris is unknown. Samples were given to a laboratory in Anchorage to find out what is covering the animals. The Coast Guard has not received any reports of damaged or sunken ships in the area, but a team will be established this evening to find the source and cause. Gamble City Clerk Michael James says the mayor of Gamble has been in contact with the mayor of Savoonga, the Coast Guard, the DEC, the Village Corporation, and the Tribal Council.
You know, they're coordinating an effort to get a team together to go and try and find out where the source of this oil is.
The area is designated as critical habitat for spectacled and stellar eiders, listed as threatened species under the Endangered Species Act. But the area is also home to seabirds, mammals, clams, crabs, and vegetation the people of Savoonga and Gamble depend upon. James says finding the source is critically important.
Everything we harvest is from the ocean, pretty much our seals and our wildlife and the sea plants that are gathered and the birds that feed from the sea. You know, it's we eat these things, and it's really important that we find out where this contamination is coming from.
DEC Information Officer Ty Keltner says three Coast Guard personnel and one DEC person was scheduled to land on St. Lawrence Island at 5 o'clock this evening. James says there is a team of local guides ready to work with the team arriving in Gamble tonight. Reporting in Nome, I'm Lorelei Kinnean.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what do beekeepers do with their bees in the winter? It's a tough question.
Up here in Alaska, if you don't tend to them and don't make that commitment to tend to them, they will starve to death.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Crowley, providing tanker escorts, fuel delivery, and energy support services to Alaskans for nearly 60 years. From Valdez to the North Slope, Crowley knows Alaska. CrowleyAlaska.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at FNBAlaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC.
The Republican-dominated majority of the Alaska House of Representatives has organized with a familiar face in the Speaker's chair. A majority announcement says Nikiski Representative Mike Chenault will return for a third term as Speaker. Anchorage Representative Lance Pruitt, who holds a 96-vote lead over Democrat Pete Peterson, was picked as Majority Leader. Chugiak Representative Bill Stoltz and Kodiak Representative Alan Osterman were selected as Finance Committee co-chairmen. In the Senate, Sitka Republican Bert Stedman and Juneau Democrat Dennis Egan have announced they're joining the 14-member majority caucus. Egan is the first Democrat to do so. A report was released today on the peer review process of the EPA's assessment of the Bristol Bay watershed. One of the central critiques offered by the panel of experts is that the draft document is lacking a clear purpose and objective. The input from the reviewers will be added toward a final version of the assessment, which is intended to guide EPA's decision-making process about large-scale mineral developments in Bristol Bay. KDLG's Dave Benninger has more.
The report contains the comments, recommendations, and suggestions of the 12 science and engineering experts hired by the EPA to scrutinize the draft version of the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment. The panelists convened in Anchorage in August for 3 days of meetings and to hear testimony from the public. They were then asked to examine the assessment based on 14 charge questions and submit reports back to the EPA, all aimed at establishing the scientific credibility of the study. Rick Parkin, EPA's manager for the project, was unavailable for comment Friday, but the released report does say that the EPA has begun taking steps to incorporate some of the key input provided by the peer reviewers. Topping the list of the experts' critiques is that the EPA should clarify the overall purpose and objective of the assessment. That's a critique that's long been raised by the Pebble Partnership. Spokesperson Mike Heatwell.
It's not clear. Is it a watershed assessment? Is it an ecological risk assessment? It reads a lot like a draft environmental impact statement. And when you look at it, it really doesn't know what it wants to be. And in that, when it doesn't have clear objectives, it tries to pull in all kinds of conclusions through that lens, and it presents a very flawed document.
Dr. Roy Stein of Ohio State University's Aquatic Ecology Lab chaired the peer review panel. In his written comments for the report, he offered similar criticism, calling for a succinct statement of purpose and scope to be included early in the initial chapter. Senator Lisa Murkowski has long been critical of the assessment and issued a written statement Friday saying it's clear that the EPA still has a lot of work to do if the goal is to issue a scientifically sound document. But others, reading through the 193 pages of the report on Friday, see a validation of the work done by the EPA. Kim Williams is the executive director of NUNAMTA Alukastai.
I'm pleasantly surprised and pleased that the report has come out that shows that they're right on track, and if not, they really understated the risk and realized that EPA probably understated the risk that a mine would have on salmon and people and Bristol Bay.
Along with testimony and the more than 230,000 letters received during an earlier public comment period, the peer review report will be used by the EPA to shape a final version of the Bristol Bay Watershed Assessment, with no date yet as to when that will be released. In Dillingham, I'm Dave Benninger.
The energy company Hillcorp has announced another step toward finalizing its acquisition of Cook Inlet assets from Marathon. The transaction had been under investigation by the Federal Trade Commission, but that investigation has closed, and the deal will move forward as South Central Alaska braces for a possible natural gas shortage in the coming years. KDLL's Shailen Cochran has more.
In letters to both Hillcorp and Marathon, the FTC notified the companies that it had closed its investigation of the purchase of Marathon's assets in Cook Inlet as a possible violation of both the Clayton Act and the Federal Trade Commission Act. In a separate statement released by the FTC Wednesday, the commission said the transaction raised, quote, competitive concerns for the commission because Marathon, Hillcorp, and ConocoPhillips today account for over 90% of the natural gas produced in Cook Inlet, end quote. The commission was also concerned that because Hillcorp will control all of the gas storage capacity in South Central Alaska and the majority of the infrastructure necessary to deliver the gas, there is a potential to, quote, impair efforts to bolster natural gas production from sources other than Hillcorp, end quote. In an October presentation to the Regulatory Commission of Alaska and several South Central utility companies, Petrotechnical Resources of Alaska managing partner Tom Walsh presented a dim outlook for the immediate future of energy supply and demand dynamics in South Central, concluding that importing natural gas would be the only way to ensure stable supplies until more development from Cook Inlet comes online. That's where the Hillcorp deal with Marathon comes in. Hillcorp spokesperson Lori Nelson wouldn't go so far as to say that short-term energy needs outweigh the FTC's concerns, but that they do recognize that demand will soon outpace production.
Getting support for the acquisition is of the utmost importance to us. At this time, there will be a 60-day comment period that is part of the process and the approval of the consent decree. And we hope that folks will reach out and support the acquisition, because until this decree is actually approved by the court, we won't be able to move forward with any of our development plans.
In its statement Wednesday, the FTC said the concerns about both energy security and the competitive implications of the agreement led the Alaska Attorney General's Office to file a consent decree and recommend the merger not be challenged. Nelson says cooperation from the state of Alaska, including the Attorney General and the Department of Natural Resources, made this next step possible.
The state led an effort which resulted in this consent decree to further the process for the acquisition. They recognize that we're here and we're a reputable company and we're willing to make the investments necessary to further develop and increase production out of the basin. And so they basically took the lead with the FTC in this process to put the solution in place.
Terms of the consent decree include price caps for customers over the next 5 years, among others. Under the control of Marathon, net production from the assets in question averaged 93 million cubic feet per day of gas and 112 barrels per day of oil in 2011. Nelson says that until the deal is finalized, they can't say what their production plans will be. Reporting from Kenai, I'm Shailen Cochran.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Join Alaska bars and restaurants from every corner of the state in taking a stand against secondhand smoke. The fact of the matter is, no Alaskan, employee, or customer should suffer the heart disease and lung cancer due to secondhand smoke. The benefits are undeniably positive for Alaskans and for the bottom line. Clean indoor air. It's good for health and it's great for business. For more information on smoke-free workplaces, visit alaskatca.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Peter Granitz. This week on AK, bees. Surviving winter in Alaska is not easy for us humans, and for honeybees, it's even harder. Honeybees don't naturally exist in North America, and in northern climates, the flowering season is too short and the winter is too long. But a few dedicated beekeepers in the state are working on ways to keep their hives alive, despite the obstacles. AK's Ann Hillman cautiously checked it out.
Let's just start with a fun fact about me.
I'm allergic to bees, which means there was no way I was going to go shove my mic in a hive while local beekeepers harvested honey last summer. Instead, I stood timidly behind a small fountain as Anchorage residents Ross Mason and Brian Thompson admired their backyard hive.
Just wait a while. You'll start seeing a highway.
If you look here, you can see a highway
of
bees.
They're everywhere.
See them?
See them coming and going?
Just along this stretch.
Mason, wearing shorts and a t-shirt, boldly took the mic into the fray. And returned unscathed.
They know that I'm not there to rob the hive, steal any of their food, and they leave me alone. They have a job to do. So.
But what happens when you do go to harvest?
Head to toe covered up. Because they know you're robbing from them.
Mason and Thompson love their bees, but their relationship is seasonal. At the end of the summer, they have to decide what to do with their hives. In previous years, they, like many other Alaskan beekeepers, euthanized their bees by dumping them into a bucket of soapy water.
It's very hard to do that, and it sounds kind of cruel, but up here in Alaska, if you don't tend to them and don't make that commitment to tend to them, they will starve to death.
And it is a commitment. Chugiak beekeeper Tom Elliott has been overwintering his bees for over a decade.
This is the feeder I was talking about. They pour sugar syrup in here. I can pour.
Elliott shows me his stacks of wintering supplies in the corner of his barn, 2-inch thick foam boxes that he slides over his hives to help keep them warm, and his homemade feeder.
There's a float in there, and the bees come up from the front, the bottom of this.
Every fall, he mixes 100 pounds of sugar with water to produce a thick syrup for his bees to suck up, then turn into food stores for the winter. But even if the bees have plenty of food to survive, they can't always get to it. The bees keep warm by clustering together in a ball around the queen. As long as they're together, they can survive outside temperatures well below zero. But as soon as one moves away from the group to eat,
their body temperature only has to drop to about 44 degrees. And they're no longer able to fly. A bee can't even digest honey at below something around 40 degrees. They'll starve to death even if they've got honey available. You know, it's an amazing system. We have bees that can survive 60 below, but one lone bee can't even survive 40 degrees.
And so the numbers in the colony dwindle. They also have to battle parasitic mites, fungus, and moisture. If a bee colony does make it through the winter, then it's generally weak and depleted. That's why one Alaskan beekeeper is trying to make the bees themselves stronger.
But as far as my breed goes, I tell them I ain't making no claims. As far as they're being better or better honey producers, better winners or anything, all my claim is it's genetics that has wintered in Alaska.
Bee breeder Keith Malone says the genetics of the bee matter, so he doesn't pamper his hives. Unlike typical beekeepers who are trying to winter over their bees, he doesn't harvest the honey, then give them sugar. They have to survive on what they gather themselves during the short summer. He doesn't wrap his boxes to help keep them warm. He says he breeds the bees to be hardier. He also breeds them to be smaller, which means being born in smaller honeycomb cells.
They can manage diseases, parasites, and maladies on their own without chemicals.
And the smaller cell helps that?
The smaller cell helps that. It changes the dynamics of the colony. There's more bees born on cells that are small in a given square inch than on large cell.
He says the smaller size means more bees in the hive, which means more individuals to do the work, and a stronger hive headed into the long winter. So far, his strategy has worked. Malone started with a Russian queen bee 10 years ago and is still breeding her offspring to this day. He sells his queens as Alaskan honeybees. Mason and Thompson, the beekeepers who began this story, haven't bought any of the Alaskan honeybees yet, but they're thinking about it.
And there are beekeepers out there that will hear us speaking of euthanizing bees and we'll get hate mail. You know.
This year, they gave their bees away. If overwintering bees becomes easier and more successful, they may never have to euthanize again. For AK, I'm Ann Hillman.
Now it's time for 300 Villages. This week, we're heading to Savunga, one of two communities on the northern edge of St. Lawrence Island in the Bering Sea.
My name is Pearl Anaria. I'm city clerk with the city of Savunga. what people are doing is kind of getting ready for the cold winter that's coming up. Well, they're getting logs just in case, you know, they have no heat, and they use the wood for their heat. The ocean is all around the Bering Sea, and but the beaches used to look longer, but I guess they eroded by how many years? Because when I was younger, it was a lot longer, but it eroded. There is open gym when there is at times, and what the school is doing is having the seniors or the sports students, you know, who like sports, to try to sponsor dances during the weekend, so to help them make money, fundraise. It is sometimes hard for people to find jobs, but they still manage. People around here like to live here. Suvungga is very small, but it is, could be quite beautiful at times, most of the time, but during winter it's very cold and windy and harsh, but we manage.
Pearl Anungayak is the city clerk in Suvungga. 300 Villages is AK's attempt to put every community in Alaska on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK This Week. We had help from Ann Hillman, Annie Feit, and Dave Waldron. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Peter Granitz.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Anchorage, Emily Schwing in Fairbanks, Lorelei Kanin in Nome, Dave Benninger in Dillingham, and Shailen Cochran in Kenai. Peter Granitz was our AK guest host this week. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. The Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports. FAA.gov/go/flyalaska or toll free at 1-866-357-4704.
And by
Providence Imaging Center, helping cancer patients stay in Anchorage with a PET scanner that fuses anatomical and functional images since 2004. Learn more at provimaging.com.
Increasing energy efficiency is an easy way to reduce energy consumption and save money. The Alaska Housing Finance Corporation now offers financing to publicly owned facilities to make improvements to increase energy efficiency. Find out more about how their loan program works and if there are public buildings in your community that are a good fit for the Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Program at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by AHFC.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.